Side 4, Domes of Fire, The Tomily, Book 1, by David Eddings, continuing on page 123. Then, always the opportunist, he sidled up to Aileen. "Don't you feel sorry for me?" he asked her in an insinuating voice.
"Colton?" Mirtai snapped. "No!"
"I was only..." She smacked him sharply on the nose with two fingers, much as one would do to persuade a puppy to give up the notion of chewing on a pair of shoes. "That hurt," he protested, putting his hand to his nose.
"It was meant to. Leave her alone."
"Are you going to let her do that, Sparhawk?" Colton appealed to his friend. "Do as she says," Sparhawk told him. "Leave the girl alone." "Your morning's not going too well, is it, Sir Colton?" Stragan noted. Colton went off to a corner to sulk. The others drifted in, and they all sat down to the breakfast two crewmen brought from the galley. Princess Danae sat alone near the large window at the stern, where the salt-tinged breeze would keep the smell of pork sausage from her delicate nostrils. After breakfast, Sparhawk and Colton went up on deck for a breath of air, and stood leaning on the port rail watching the south coast of Camoria slide by. The day was particularly fine. The sun was very bright, and the sky very blue. There was a good following breeze, and their ship, her white sails spread wide, led the small flotilla across the white-cap-speckled sea. "The captain says that we should pass Maruscum about noon," Colton said. "We're making better time than we expected." "We've got a good breeze," Sparhawk agreed. "How's your back?" "Sore. I've got bruises from my hips to my neck." "At least you're standing up straight," Colton grunted sourly. "Mirtai's very direct, isn't she? I still don't know exactly what to make of her. What I mean is, how are we supposed to treat her? She's obviously a woman. You've noticed." "Very funny, Sparhawk. What I'm getting at is the fact that you can't really treat her like a woman. She's as big as Ulat, and she seems to expect us to accept her as a comrade in arms. So? It's unnatural." "Just treat her as a special case. That's what I do. It's easier than arguing with her." "Are you in the mood for a bit of advice?" "That depends on the advice." "Mirtai feels that it's her duty to protect the royal family, and she's extended that to include my wife's maid. I'd strongly recommend that you curb your instincts. We don't fully understand Mirtai, and so we don't know exactly how far she'll go. Even if Aileen seems to be encouraging you, I wouldn't pursue the matter. It could be very dangerous."
"The girl likes me," Colton objected.
"I've been around long enough to know that."
"You might be right, but I'm not sure if that'll make any difference to Mirtai. Do me a favor, Colton. Just leave the girl alone."
"But she's the only one on board ship," Colton protested.
"You'll live."
Sparhawk turned and saw Patriarch Emban and Ambassador Oscania standing near the stern. They were an oddly matched pair. The Patriarch of Usera had laid aside his cassock for the voyage and wore instead a brown jerkin over a plain robe. He was very nearly as wide as he was tall, and he had a florid face. Oscania, on the other hand, was a slight man with fine bones and little flesh. His skin was a pallid bronze color. Their minds, however, were very similar. They were both consummate politicians. Sparhawk and Colton drifted back to join them.
"All power comes from the throne in Tomily or Grace," Oscania was explaining. "Nothing is done there except at the express instruction of the Emperor."
"We delegate things in Eosia, Your Excellency," Emban told him. "We pick a good man, tell him what we want done, and leave the details up to him."
"We've tried that, and it doesn't really work in our culture. Our religion is fairly superficial, and it doesn't encourage the kind of personal loyalty yours does."
"Your emperor has to make all the decisions?" Emban asked, a bit incredulously. "How does he find the time?"
Oscania smiled.
"No, no, Your Grace. Day-to-day decisions are all taken care of by custom and tradition. We're great believers in custom and tradition. It's one of our more serious failings. Once a Tamil moves out of those realms,
he's obliged to improvise, and that's when he usually gets into trouble. His improvisations always seem to be guided by self-interest for some reason. We've discovered that it's best to discourage these expeditions into free decision-making. By definition, the Emperor is all-wise anyway, so it's probably best to leave these things in his hands. A standard definition isn't always very accurate, Your Excellency. All-wise means different things when it's applied to different people. We have one ourselves. We like to say that the archprelate is guided by the voice of God. There have been a number of archprelates in the past who didn't listen very well, though.
We've noticed the same sort of thing, Your Grace. The definition of all-wise does seem to have a wide range of meaning. To be honest with you, my friend, we've had some frightfully stupid emperors from time to time. We're rather fortunate just now, though. Emperor Sarabian is moderately accomplished.
What's he like?
Emban asked intently.
He's an institution, unfortunately. He's as much at the mercy of custom and tradition as we are. He's obliged to speak in formulas, so it's almost impossible to get to know him.
The ambassador smiled.
The visit of Queen Elana may just jerk him into humanity. He'll have to treat her as an equal, for political reasons, and he was raised to believe that he didn't have any equals. I hope your lovely blonde queen is gentle with him. I think I like him, or I would if I could get past all the formalities, and it would just be too bad if she happened to say something that stopped his heart. Elana knows exactly what she's doing every minute of the day, Your Excellency,
Amban assured him.
You and I are babies compared to her. You don't have to tell her I said that, Sparhawk.
What's my silence worth to you, Your Grace? Sparhawk grinned.
Emban glowered at him for a moment. What are we likely to encounter in Astel, Your Excellency?
Tears, probably, Oscania replied.
I beg your pardon?
The Astels are an emotional people. They cry at the drop of a handkerchief. Their culture is much like that of the Kingdom of Pelosia. They're tediously devout and invincibly backward. It's been demonstrated to them over and over again that serfdom is an archaic, inefficient institution. But they maintain it anyway, largely at the connivance of the serfs themselves. Astellian nobles don't exert themselves in any way, so they have no concept of the extent of human endurance. Their serfs take advantage of that outrageously. Astellian serfs have been known to collapse from sheer exhaustion at the very mention of such unpleasant words as reaping or digging. The weepy nobles are tender-hearted, so the serfs get away with it almost every time. Western Astel's a silly place, filled with silly people. That changes as one moves east.
One would hope so. I'm not certain just how much silliness I can...
It was that same flicker of darkness at the very edge of Sparhawk's vision, and it was accompanied by that same chill. Patriarch Emban broke off, turning his head quickly to try to see it more clearly.
What?
It'll pass, Sparhawk told him tersely. Try to concentrate on it, Your Grace, and you as well, if you don't mind, Your Excellency.
They were seeing the shadow for the first time, and their initial reactions might be useful. Sparhawk watched them closely as they tried to turn their heads to look directly at the annoying darkness just beyond the range of sight. Then the shadow was gone.
All right, Sparhawk said crisply. Exactly what did you see?
I couldn't see anything, Carlton told him. It was like having someone trying to sneak up behind me.
Although Carlton had seen the cloud several times, this was the first time he had encountered the shadow.
What was it, Sir Sparhawk? Ambassador Oscania asked.
I'll explain in a moment, Your Excellency. Please try to remember exactly what you saw and felt.
It was something dark, Oscania replied. Very dark. It seemed to be quite substantial, but somehow it was able to move just enough to stay where I couldn't quite see it. No matter how quickly I turned my head or moved my eyes, it was never where I could see it directly. It felt as if it were standing just behind my head.
Emban nodded.
And it made me feel cold.
He shuddered.
I'm still cold, as a matter of fact.
It was unfriendly, too, Carlton added.
not quite ready to attack, but very nearly.
Anything else? Sparhawk asked them. Anything at all, no matter how small.
There was a peculiar odor,
Oscania told him. Sparhawk looked at him sharply. He had never noticed that. Could you describe it, Your Excellency?
I seemed to catch the faintest smell of tainted meat, a haunch or a side that had been left hanging for perhaps a week too long.
Colton grunted.
I caught that too, Sparhawk, just for a second, and it left a very bad taste in my mouth.
Emban nodded vigorously.
I'm an expert on flavors. It was definitely rotten meat.
We were sort of standing in a semicircle, Sparhawk mused, and we all saw or sensed it right behind us. Did any of you see it behind anybody else? They all shook their heads.
Would you please explain this, Sparhawk?
Emban said irritably. In just a moment, Your Grace. Sparhawk crossed the deck to a sailor who was splicing a loop into a bite of a rope. He spoke with the tar-smeared man for a few minutes and then returned.
He saw it too, he reported.
Let's spread out and talk with the rest of the sailors on deck. I'm not being deliberately secretive, gentlemen, but let's get what information we can from the sailors before they forget the incident entirely. I'd like to know just how widespread this visitation was.
It was about a half hour later when they gathered again near the aft companionway, and they had all begun to exhibit a kind of excitement.
One of the sailors heard a kind of crackling noise, like a large fire, Carlton reported.
I talked to one fellow, and he thought there was a kind of reddish tinge to the shadow, Oscania added.
No, Emban disagreed. It was green. The sailor I talked with said that it was definitely green.
And I spoke with a man who'd just come up on deck, and he hadn't seen or felt a thing, Sparhawk added.
This is all very interesting, Sir Sparhawk, Oscania said, but could you please explain it to us?
Carlton already knows, Your Excellency, Sparhawk replied. It would appear that we've just been visited by the troll gods.
Be careful, Sparhawk, Emban warned. You're walking on the edge of heresy.
The church knights are permitted to do that, Your Grace. Anyway, that shadow's followed me before, and Elana's seen it too. We'd assumed it was because we were wearing the rings. The stones in the rings were fashioned from shards of the Bellium. The shadow seems to be a little less selective now.
That's all it is? Just a shadow? Oscania asked him.
Sparhawk shook his head. It can also show up as a very dark cloud, and everybody can see that.
But not the things that are concealed in it, Carlton added.
Such as what? Oscania asked.
Sparhawk gave Emban a quick sidelong glance. It would start an argument, Your Excellency, and we don't really want to spend the morning in a theological debate, do we?
I'm not all that doctrinaire, Sparhawk, Emban protested.
What would be your immediate response if I told you that humans and trolls are related, Your Grace?
I'd have to investigate the condition of your soul.
Then I'd probably better not tell you the truth about our cousins, wouldn't you say? Anyway, Afriel told us that the shadow, and later the cloud, were manifestations of the troll gods.
Who's Afriel? Oscania asked.
We had a tutor in the Styric arts when we were novices, Your Excellency, Sparhawk explained. Afriel is her goddess. We thought that the cloud was somehow related to Azash, but we were wrong about that. The reddish color and the heat that one sailor sensed was Quaj, the god of fire. The greenish color and that rotten meat smell was Gnome, the god of eat. Colton was frowning.
I thought it was just one of those things you might expect from sailors, he said. But one fellow told me that he had some rather overpowering thoughts about women while the shadow was lurking behind him. Don't the trolls have a god of mating?
I think so, Sparhawk replied. Ulath would know.
This is all very interesting, Sir Sparhawk, Oscania said dubiously. But I don't quite see its relevance.
You've been encountering supernatural incidents that seem to be connected to the turmoil in Tamale, Your Excellency. There's almost exactly the same sort of disturbances cropping up in Lamorkand, and the same sort of unnatural events accompanying them.
We were questioning a man who knew some things about it once, and the cloud engulfed him and killed him before he could talk. That strongly suggests some kind of connection. The shadow may have been present in Tomalley as well, but no one would have recognized it for what it really is.
Zelasta was right, then, Oscania murmured. You are the man for this job.
The troll gods are following you again, Sparhawk, Carlton said. What is this strange fascination they seem to have with you? We can probably discount your looks, but then again, maybe not. They're used to trolls, after all.
Sparhawk looked meaningfully at the ship rail.
How would you like to run alongside the ship for a while, Carlton? No, that's all right, Sparhawk. I got all the exertion I need for the day when Mirtai decided to use me for a rug.
The wind held, and the sky remained clear. They rounded the southern tip of Zemok and sailed up the east coast in a northeasterly direction. Once, when Sparhawk and his daughter were standing in the bow, he decided to satisfy a growing curiosity.
How long have we actually been at sea, Danae? He asked her directly.
5 days, she replied.
It seems like 2 weeks or more.
Thank you, Father. Does that answer your question about how well I can manage time?
We certainly haven't eaten as much in 5 days as we would have in 2 weeks. Won't our cooks get suspicious?
Look behind us, Father. Why do you suppose all those fish are gleefully jumping out of the water? And what are all those seagulls doing following us?
Maybe they're feeding.
Very perceptive, Sparhawk. But what could possibly be out there for that many of them to eat? Unless, of course, somebody's been throwing food to them off the aft deck.
When do you do that?
At night.
She shrugged.
The fish are terribly grateful. I think they're right on the verge of worshipping me.
She laughed.
I've never been worshipped by fish before, and I don't really speak their language very well. It's mostly bubbles. Can I have a pet whale?
No. You've already got a kitten.
I'll pout.
It makes you look silly, but go ahead if you feel like it.
Why can't I have a whale?
Because they can't be housebroken. They don't make good pets.
That's a ridiculous answer, Sparhawk.
It was a ridiculous request, Afriel.
The port of Salesha, at the head of the Gulf of Daconia, was an ugly city that reflected the culture that had prevailed in Zemok for 1900 years. The Zemoks appeared to be confused by what had happened in their capital 6 years before. No matter how often they were assured that Otha and Azash were no more, they still tended to start violently at sudden loud noises, and they generally reacted to any sort of surprise by running away.
"I'd strongly recommend that we spend the night on board our ships, Your Majesty," Stragan advised the Queen after he had made a brief survey of the accommodations available in the city. "I wouldn't kennel dogs in the finest house in Salesha."
"That bad?"
she asked.
"Worse, my Queen."
And so they stayed on board and set out early the following morning. The road they followed north was truly bad, and the carriage in which the Queen and her entourage rode jolted and creaked as their column wound up into the low range of mountains lying between the coast and the town of Bosna. After they had been traveling for no more than an hour, Talon rode forward. As the Queen's page, it was one of the boy's duties to carry messages for her. Talon was not alone on his horse this time, however. Sparhawk's daughter rode behind him, her arms about his waist and her cheek resting against his back.
"She wants to ride with you," Talon told Sparhawk. "Your wife, Emban, and the ambassador are talking politics. The princess kept yawning in their faces until the queen gave her permission to get out of the carriage."
Sparhawk nodded. The suddenly acquired timidity of the Zemoks made this part of the trip fairly safe. He reached over and lifted his daughter onto Farron's back in front of his saddle.
"I thought you liked politics,"
he said to her after Talon had returned to his post beside the carriage.
"Oscania is describing the organization of the Tamil Empire," she replied. "I already know about that. He's not making too many mistakes."
"Are you going to shrink the distance from here to Bosna?"
"Unless you enjoy long, tedious journeys through boring terrain. Farron and the other horses appreciate my shortening things up a bit, don't you, Farron?"
The big roan nickered enthusiastically. "He's such a nice horse," Danae said, leaning back against her father's armored chest.
"Farron? He's a foul-tempered brute."
"That's because you expect him to be that way, father. He's only trying to please you." She rapped on his armor. "I'm going to have to do something about this," she said. "How can you stand that awful smell?"
"You get used to it."
The church knights were all wearing full armor, and brightly colored pennons snapped from their lances. Sparhawk looked around to be sure no one was close enough to overhear them.
"Afriel," he said quietly, "can you arrange things so that I can see real time?"
"Nobody can see time, Sparhawk.
You know what I mean. I want to see what's really going on, not the illusion you create to keep what you're doing a secret."
"Why?"
"I like to know what's going on, that's all."
"You won't like it," she warned.
"I'm a church knight. I'm supposed to do things I don't like."
"If you insist, father." He was not entirely certain what he had expected. Some jerky, accelerated motion, perhaps, and the voices of his friends sounding like the twittering of birds as they condensed long conversations into little bursts of unintelligible babble. That was not what happened, however. Farron's gait became impossibly smooth. The big horse seemed almost to flow across the ground, or, more properly, the ground seemed to flow back beneath his hooves. Sparhawk swallowed hard and looked around at his companions. Their faces seemed blank, wooden, and their eyes half-closed.
"They're sleeping just now," Afriel explained. "They're all quite comfortable. They believe that they've had a good supper and that the sun's gone down. I fixed them a rather nice campsite." "Stop the horse, father. You can help me get rid of the extra food."
"Can't you just make it vanish?"
"And waste it?"
She sounded shocked.
"The birds and animals have to eat too, you know."
"How long is it really going to take us to reach Bosna?"
2 days. We could go faster if there was an emergency, but there's nothing quite that serious going on just now."
Sparhawk reined in and followed his little daughter back to where the pack animals stood patiently.
"You're keeping all of this in your head at the same time?" he asked her.
"It's not that difficult, Sparhawk. You just have to pay attention to details, that's all."
"You sound like Keurig."
"He'd have made an excellent god, actually. Attention to detail is the most important lesson we learn. Put that beef shoulder over near the tree with the broken-off top. There's a bear cub back in the bushes who got separated from his mother. He's very hungry."
"Do you keep track of every single thing that's happening around you?"
"Well, somebody has to, Sparhawk."
The Zemok town of Bosna lay in a pleasant valley where the main east-west road forded a small, sparkling river. It was a fairly important trading center. Not even Azash had been able to curb the natural human instinct to do business. There was an encampment just outside of town. Sparhawk had dropped back to return Princess Danae to her mother, so he was riding beside the carriage as they started down into the valley. Mirtai seemed uncharacteristically nervous as the carriage moved down toward the encampment.
"It appears that your admirer has obeyed your summons, Mirtai,"
Baroness Melodir observed brightly.
"Of course,"
the giantess replied.
"It must be enormously satisfying to have such absolute control over a man." "I rather like it,"
Mirtai admitted.
"How do I look? Be honest, Melodir. I haven't seen Kring for months, and I wouldn't want to disappoint him." "You're lovely, Mirtai."
"You're not just saying that?"
"Of course not."
"What do you think, Elana?"
The Tamil woman appealed to her owner. Her tone was a bit uncertain.
"You're ravishing, Mirtai."
"I'll know better when I see his face."
Mirtai paused.
"Maybe I should marry him," she said. "I think I'd feel much more secure if I had my brand on him."
She rose, opening the carriage door and leaning out to pull her tethered horse up from behind the carriage, and then quite literally flowed onto his back. Mirtai never used a saddle.
"Well," she sighed, "I guess I'd better go down there and find out if he still loves me."
And she tacked her heels into her horse's flanks and galloped on down into the valley to meet the waiting Domi. Chapter 9. The Peloi were nomadic herders from the marches of eastern Pelosia. They were superb horsemen and savage warriors. They spoke a somewhat archaic form of Alenic, and many of the words in their tongue had fallen out of use in the modern language. Among those words was Domi, a word filled with profoundest respect. It meant chief, sort of, although, as Sir Ulath had once said, it lost a great deal in translation. The current Domi of the Peloi was named Kring. Kring was a lean man of slightly more than medium height. As was customary among the men of his people, he shaved his head, and there were savage-looking saber scars on his scalp and face, an indication that the process of rising to a position of leadership among the Peloi involved a certain amount of rough-and-tumble competition. He wore black leather clothing, and a lifetime spent on horseback had made him bandy-legged. He was a fiercely loyal friend, and he had worshipped Mirtai from the moment he had first seen her. Mirtai did not discourage him, although she refused to commit herself. They made an odd-looking couple, since the Aton woman towered more than a foot over her ardent suitor. Peloi hospitality was generous, and the business of taking salt together usually involved enormous amounts of roasted meat, during the consumption of which the men spoke of affairs, a phrase with many implications, ranging in subject matter from the weather to formal declarations of war. After they had eaten, Kring described what he had observed during the ride of the 100 Peloi across Semach. "It never really was a kingdom, friend Sparhawk," he said. "Not the way we understand a word. There are too many different kinds of people living in Semach for them all to come together under one roof. The only thing that kept them united was their fear of Otha and Azash. Now that their emperor and their god aren't there anymore, the Zemachs are just kind of drifting apart. There's not any sort of war or anything like that. It's just that they don't stay in touch with each other anymore. They all have their own concerns, so they don't really have any reason to talk to each other." "Is there any kind of government at all?" Tinian asked the shaved-headed Domi. "There's a sort of framework, friend Tinian," Kring replied. They were sitting in a large open pavilion in the center of the Peloi encampment, feasting on roast ox. The sun was just going down, and the shadows of the peaks lying to the west lay long across the pleasant valley. There were lights in the windows of Vosna, a half mile or so away. "The departments of Otha's government have all moved to Gonadoret," Kring elaborated. "Nobody will even go near the city of Zemach anymore. The bureaucrats in Gonadoret spend their time writing directives, but their messengers usually just stop in the nearest village, tear up the directives, wait a suitable period of time, and then go back and tell their employers that all is going well. The bureaucrats are happy, the messengers don't have to travel very far, and the people go on about their business. Actually, it's not a bad form of government."
"And their religion?" Sir Bevier asked intently.
Bevier was a devout young knight, and he spent a great deal of his time talking and thinking about God. His companions liked him in spite of that.
"They don't speak very much about their beliefs, friend Bevier," Kring replied. "It was their religion that got them into trouble in the first place, so they're a bit shy about discussing the matter openly. They grow their crops, tend their sheep and goats, and let the gods settle their own disputes. They're not a threat to anybody anymore."
"Except for the fact that a disintegrated nation is an open invitation to anyone nearby with anything even remotely resembling an army," Ambassador Oscania added.
"Why would anyone want to bother, Your Excellency?" Strachan asked him. "There's nothing in Zemach of any value. The thieves there have to get honest jobs in order to make ends meet. Otha's gold appears to have been an illusion. It all vanished when Azash died."
He smiled sardonically.
"And you have no idea of how chagrined any number of people who'd supported the Primate of Simura were when that happened."
Just then, something rather peculiar happened to Kring's face.
the savage horseman, whose very name struck fear into the hearts of his neighbors, went first pale, then bright red. Mirtai had emerged from the women's pavilion to which Paloi custom had relegated her and the others. Strangely, Queen Aelana had not even objected, a fact that caused Sparhawk a certain nervousness. Mirtai had taken advantage of the accommodations within the pavilion to make herself presentable. Kring, quite obviously, was impressed. "You'll excuse me," he said, rising quickly and moving directly toward the lodestar of his life.
"I think we're in the presence of a legend in the making," Tinian noted.
"The Paloi will compose songs about Kring and Mirtai for the next 100 years at least." He looked at the Tamul ambassador.
"Is Mirtai behaving at all the way other Aton women do, Your Excellency? She obviously likes Kring's attentions, but she simply won't give him a definite answer."
"The Aton's doing what's customary, Sir Tinian," Oscania replied. "Aton women believe in long, leisurely courtships. They find being pursued entertaining, and most men turn their attentions to other matters after the wedding. For this period of time in her life, she knows that she's the absolute center of the Domi's attention. Women, I'm told, appreciate that sort of thing." "She wouldn't just be leading him on, would she?" Barrett asked. "I like the Domi, and I'd hate to see him get his heart broken." "Oh, no, Sir Barrett. She's definitely interested. If she found his attentions annoying, she'd have killed him a long time ago."
"Courtship among the Aetons must be a very nervous business," Carlton observed.
"Oh, yes," Oscania laughed. "A man must be very careful. If he's too aggressive, the woman will kill him. And if he's not aggressive enough, she'll marry someone else."
"That's very uncivilized," Carlton said disapprovingly.
"Aeton women seem to enjoy it. But then, women are more elemental than we are." They left Bosna early the following morning and rode eastward toward Issos, on the border between Zemach and the kingdom of Astel. It was a peculiar journey for Sparhawk. It took 3 days. He was absolutely certain of that. He could clearly remember every minute of those 3 days and every mile they traveled. And yet his daughter periodically roused him when he was firmly convinced that he was sleeping in a tent, and he would be startled to find that he was dozing on Farron's back instead, and that the position of the sun clearly indicated that what had appeared to be a full day's travel had taken less than 6 hours. Princess Danae woke her father for a very practical reason during what was in reality no more than a one-day ride. The addition of the Paloi had greatly increased the amount of stores that had to be carefully depleted each night, and Danae made her father help her dispose of the excess.
"What did you do with all the supplies when we were traveling with Wargan's army?" Sparhawk asked her on the second night, which actually consumed about a half hour during the early afternoon of that endless day.
"I did it the other way."
She shrugged. "Other way?"
"I just made the excess go away."
"Couldn't you do that this time, too?"
"Of course, but then I couldn't leave it for the animals. Besides, this gives you and me the chance to talk when nobody's around to hear us. Pour that sack of grain under those bushes, Sparhawk. There's a covey of quail back in the grass. They haven't been eating very well lately, and the chicks are growing very fast right now."
"Was there something you wanted to talk about?" he asked her, slitting open the grain sack with his dagger.
"Nothing special," she said. "I just like talking with you, and you're usually too busy."
"And this gives you a chance to show off, too, doesn't it?"
"I suppose it does, yes. It's not all that much fun being a goddess if you can't show off just a little bit now and then."
"I love you," he laughed.
"Oh, that's very nice, Sparhawk," she exclaimed happily. "Right from the heart and without even thinking about it. Would you like to have me turn the grass lavender for you, just to show my appreciation?"
"I'll settle for a kiss. Lavender grass might confuse the horses."
They reached Issos that evening. The child goddess so perfectly melded real and apparent time that they fit together seamlessly. Sparhawk was a church knight, trained in the use of magic, but his imagination shuddered back from the kind of power possessed by this whimsical little divinity, who, she had announced during the confrontation with Azash and the city of Zemach, had willed herself into existence, and who had decided independently to be reborn as his daughter. They set up for the night some distance from town, and after they had eaten, Talon and Stragan took Sparhawk aside.
"What's your feeling about a bit of reconnoitering?" Stragan asked the big Pandion. "What did you have in mind?" "Issos is a fair-sized town," the blonde Thalesian replied, "and there's sure to be a certain amount of organization among the thieves there. I thought the three of us might be able to pick up some useful information by getting in touch with their leader."
"Would he know you?"
"I doubt it. Emsat's a long way away from here."
"What makes you think he'd want to talk with you?"
"Courtesy, Sparhawk. Thieves and murderers are exquisitely courteous to each other. It's healthier that way."
"If he doesn't know who you are, how will he know that he's supposed to be courteous toward you?"
"There are certain signals he'll recognize." "You people have a very complex society, don't you?" "All societies are complex, Sparhawk. It's one of the burdens of civilization."
"Sometime you'll have to teach me these signals."
"No, I don't think so."
"Why not?"
"Because you're not a thief. It's another of those complexities we were talking about. The point of all of this is that all we have to work with is the ambassador's rather generalized notion of what's going on. I think I'd like something a bit more specific, wouldn't you?"
"That I would, my friend."
"Then why don't we drift on into Issos and see what we can find out?"
"Why don't we?" The three of them changed into nondescript clothing and rode away from the encampment, circling around to the west to approach the town from that direction. As they approached, Talon looked critically at the fortifications and the unguarded gate. "They seem a little relaxed when you consider how close they are to the Zemach border," he observed.
"Zemach doesn't pose much of a threat anymore," Stragan disagreed.
"Old customs die hard, my lord Stragan, and it hasn't been all that long since Otha was frothing at the frontier with Azash standing right behind him."
"I doubt that these people found Azash to be all that impressive," Sparhawk said. "Otha's god didn't have any reason to come this way. He was looking west, because that's where Belium was."
"I suppose you're right," Talon conceded. Issos was not a very large town, perhaps about the size of the city of Lenda in central Alenia. There was a kind of archaic quality about it, though, since there had been a town on this spot since the dawn of time. The cobbled streets were narrow and crooked, and they wandered this way and that without any particular reason.
"How are we going to find the part of town where your colleagues stay?" Sparhawk asked Stragan. "We can't just walk up to some burgher and ask him where we'll find the thieves, can we?" "We'll take care of it," Stragan smiled. "Talon, go ask some pickpocket where the thieves' den is around here."
"Right," Talon grinned, slipping down from his horse.
"That could take him all night," Sparhawk said. "Not unless he's been struck blind," Stragan replied as the boy moved off into a crowded byway. "I've seen 6 pickpockets since we came into town, and I wasn't even looking very hard."
He pursed his lips.
"Their technique's a little different here. It probably has to do with the narrow streets."
"What would that have to do with it?"
"People jostle each other in tight quarters." Stragan shrugged. "A pickpocket in Emsat or Simura could never get away with bumping into a client the way they do here. It's more efficient, I'll grant you, but it establishes bad work habits."
Talon returned after a few minutes. "It's down by the river," he reported.
"Inevitably," Stragan said. "Something seems to draw thieves to rivers. I've never been able to figure out why."
Talon shrugged. "It's probably so that we can swim for it in case things go wrong." "We'd better walk. Mounted men attract too much attention. There's a stable down at the end of the street where we can leave the horses." They spoke briefly with the surly stableman, and then proceeded on foot. The thieves' den in Issos was in a shabby tavern at the rear of a narrow cul-de-sac. A crude sign depicting a bunch of grapes hung from a rusty hook just over the door,
and a pair of burly loafers sprawled on the doorstep drinking ale from battered tankards. "We're looking for a man named Jukta," Talon told them.
"What was it about?" one of the loafers growled suspiciously.
"Business,"
Stragan told him in a cold tone.
"Anybody could say that," the unshaven man said, rising to his feet with a thick cudgel in his hand. "This is always so tedious," Stragan sighed to Sparhawk.
Then his hand flashed to the hilt of his rapier, and the slim blade came whistling out of its sheath.
"Friend," he said to the loafer, "unless you want 3 feet of steel between your breakfast and your supper, you'll stand aside."
The needle-like point of the rapier touched the man's belly suggestively. The other ruffian sidled off to one side, his hand reaching furtively toward the handle of his dagger.
"I wouldn't," Sparhawk warned him in a dreadfully quiet voice.
He pushed his cloak aside to reveal his mail shirt and the hilt of his broadsword.
"I'm not entirely positive where your breakfast or your supper are located just now, neighbor, but I'll probably be able to pick them out when your guts are lying in the street."
The fellow froze in his tracks, swallowing hard.
"The knife," Sparhawk grated. "Lose it."
The dagger clattered to the cobblestones.
"I'm so happy that we could resolve this little problem without unpleasantness," Stragan drawled. "Now, why don't we all go inside so you can introduce us to Jukta?"
The tavern had a low ceiling, and the floor was covered with moldy straw. It was lighted by a few crude lamps that burned melted tallow. Jukta was by far the hairiest man Sparhawk had ever seen. His arms and hands seemed to be covered with curly black fur. Great wads of hair protruded from the neck of his tunic. His ears and nostrils looked like birds' nests, and his beard began just under his lower eyelids.
"What's this?" he demanded, his voice issuing from somewhere behind his shaggy rug of a face.
"They made us let them come inside, Jukta," one of the men from the doorway whined, pointing at Stragan's rapier.
Jukta's piggish eyes narrowed dangerously.
"Don't be tiresome," Stragan told him, "and pay attention. I've given you the recognition signal twice already, and you didn't even notice." "I noticed. But coming in here with a sword in your hand isn't the best way to get things off to a good start. We were a little pressed for time. I think we're being followed."
Stragan sheathed his rapier.
"You're not from around here, are you?" "No. We're from Eosia." "You're a long way from home." "That was sort of the idea. Things were getting unhealthy back there." "What line are you in?" "We're vagabonds at heart, so we were seeking fame and fortune on the highways and byways of Pelosia. A high-ranking churchman suddenly fell ill and died while we were talking business with him, and the church knights decided to investigate the causes of his illness. My friends and I decided to find fresh scenery to look at right about then."
"Are those church knights really as bad as they say?"
"Worse, probably. The three of us are all that's left of a band of 30.
"Are you planning to go into business around here?"
"We haven't decided yet. We thought we'd look things over first, and make sure that the knights aren't still following us."
"Do you feel like telling us your names?"
"Not particularly. We're not sure we're going to stay, and there's not much point in making up new names if we're not going to settle down."
Jukta laughed.
"If you aren't sure you're going into business, what's the reason for this visit?"
"Courtesy, for the most part. It's terribly impolite not to pay a call on one's colleagues when one's passing through a town. And we thought it might save a bit of time if you could spare a few minutes to give us a rundown on local practices in the field of law enforcement.
I've never been to Eosia, but I'd imagine that things like that are fairly standard. Highwaymen aren't held in high regard."
"We're so misunderstood," Stragan sighed. "They have the usual sheriffs and the like, I suppose."
"There are sheriffs right enough," Jukta said. "But they don't go out into the countryside very often in this part of Astel. The nobles out there more or less police their own estates, The sheriffs are usually involved in collecting taxes, and they aren't all that welcome when they ride out of town.
That's useful. All we'd really have to deal with would be poorly trained serfs who fare better at catching chicken thieves than at dealing with serious people. Is that more or less the way it is?
Jukta nodded.
The good part is that these serf sheriffs won't go past the borders of their own estate.
That's a highwayman's dream.
Strachan grinned.
Not entirely. Jukta disagreed. It's not a good idea to make too much noise out there. The local sheriff wouldn't chase you, but he would send word to the Eton garrison up in Canny. A man can't run far enough or fast enough to get away from the Etons, and nobody's ever taught them how to take prisoners.
That could be a drawback, Strachan conceded. Is there anything else we should know about?
Did you ever hear of Ayachin?
I can't say that I have.
That could get you into all kinds of trouble.
Who is he?
Jukta turned his head.
Akros, he yelled. Come here and tell these colleagues of ours about Ayachin.
He shrugged and spread his hands.
I'm not too well versed in ancient history, he explained. Akros used to be a teacher before he got caught stealing from his employer. He may not be too coherent. He has a little problem with drink.
Akros was a shabby-looking fellow with bloodshot eyes and a 5-day growth of beard.
What was it you wanted, Jukta? He asked, swaying on his feet.
Sort through what's left of your brain and tell our friends here what you can remember about Ayachin.
The drunken pedagogue smiled, his bleary eyes coming alight. He slid into a chair and took a drink from his tankard.
I'm only a little drunk, he said.
His speech slurred.
That's true, Jukta told Strachan. When he's really drunk, he can't even talk.
How much do you gentlemen know of the history of Astel?
Akros asked them.
Not too much, Strachan admitted.
I'll touch the high spots then.
Akros leaned back in his chair.
It was in the 9th century... that one of the arch-prelates in Kyrellos decided that the Eline faith ought to be reunited, under his domination, naturally.
Naturally.
Strachan smiled.
It always seems to get down to that, doesn't it?
Akros rubbed at his face.
I'm a little shaky on this, so I might leave some things out. This was before the founding of the Church Knights, so this arch-prelate forced the kings of Eosia to provide him with armies, and they marched through Zemok. That was before Otha was born, so Zemok wasn't much of a barrier. The arch-prelate was interested in religious unity, but the noblemen in his army were more interested in conquest. They ravaged the kingdom of Astel until Ayachin came.
Talon leaned forward, his eyes bright. It was the boy's one weakness. A good story could paralyze him. Akros took another drink.
There are all sorts of conflicting stories about who Ayachin really was, he continued. Some say he was a prince, some that he was a baron, and there are even those who say he was only a serf. Anyway, whoever he was a fervent patriot. He roused such noblemen as hadn't yet gone over to the invaders, and then he did something no one had ever dared do before. He armed the serfs. The campaign against the invaders lasted for years, and after a fairly large battle that he seemed to lose, Ayachin fled southward, luring the Eosian armies into the Astel marshes in the south of the kingdom. He'd made secret alliances with patriots in Edom, and there was a huge army lining the southern fringe of the marshes. Serfs who lived in the region guided Ayachin's armies through the bogs and quicksand, but the Eosians tried to just bowl their way through, and most of them drowned.
pulled under by all that muck. The few who reached the far side were slaughtered by the combined forces of Ayachin and his Edomish allies. He was a great national hero for a time, of course, but the nobles who had been outraged because he'd armed the serfs conspired against him, and he was eventually murdered.
Why do these stories always have to end that way? Talon complained.
Our young friend here is a literary critic, Stragan said. He wants his stories to all have happy endings.
The ancient history is all well and good, Jukta growled. But the point of all this is that Ayachin's returned, or so the serfs say.
It's a part of the folklore of Astel, Akros said. Serfs used to tell each other that someday a great crisis would arise, and that Ayachin would rise from the grave to lead them again.
Stragan sighed.
Can't anyone come up with a new story?
What's that?
Jukta asked him.
Nothing, really. There's a similar story making the rounds in Eosia. Why would this concern us if we decided to go into business around here?
Part of that folklore Akros was telling you about is something that makes everybody's blood run cold. The serfs believe that when Ayachin returns, he's going to emancipate them. Now there's a hothead out there stirring them up. We don't know his real name, but the serfs call him Saber. He's going around telling them that he's actually seen Ayachin. The serfs are secretly gathering weapons, or making them. They sneak out into the forests at night to listen to this Saber make speeches. You should probably know that they're out there, since it might be dangerous if you happened upon them unexpectedly.
Jukta scratched at his shaggy beard.
I don't normally feel this way, but I wish the government would catch this Saber fellow and hang him or something. He's got the serfs all worked up about throwing off the oppressors, and he's not too specific about which oppressors he means. He could be talking about the Tamils, but many of his followers think he's talking about the upper classes. Restless serfs are dangerous serfs. Nobody knows how many of them there really are, and if they begin to get wild ideas about equality and justice, God only knows where it might end.
Chapter 10. There are just too many similarities for it to be a coincidence, Sparhawk was saying the following morning, as they rode northeasterly along the Darsus Road under a lowering sky. He and his companions had gathered around Elana's carriage to discuss Jutka's revelations. The air was close and muggy, and there was not a breath of air stirring.
I'd almost have to agree, Ambassador Oscania replied. There's a certain pattern emerging here, if what you've told me about Lamorkand is at all accurate. Our empire is certainly not democratic, and I'd imagine that your western kingdoms are much the same. But we're not really such hard masters, either of us. I think we've become the symbols of the social injustices implicit in every culture. I'm not saying that people don't hate us. Everybody in the world loathes his government. No offense intended, Your Majesty. He smiled at Elana.
I do what I can to keep my people from hating me too much, Your Excellency, she replied.
Elana wore a pale blue velvet traveling cloak, and Sparhawk felt that she looked particularly pretty this morning.
No one could possibly hate someone as lovely as you, Your Majesty.
Oscania smiled.
The point, though, is that the world seethes with discontent, and someone is playing on all those disparate resentments in an effort to bring down the established order. The Empire here in Tamale, and the monarchies and the Church in Eosia. Somebody wants there to be a great deal of turmoil, and I don't think he's motivated by a hunger for social justice.
We'd go a long way toward understanding the situation if we could pinpoint just exactly what he is after,
Emban added.
Opportunity, Ulath suggested. If everything's all settled and the wealth and power have all been distributed, there's nothing left for the people coming up the ladder. The only way they can get their share is to turn everything upside down and shake it a few times.
That's a brutal political theory, Sir Ulof, Oscania said disapprovingly.
It's a brutal world, Your Excellency.
Ulof shrugged.
I'd have to disagree,
Bevier stubbornly asserted.
Go right ahead, my young friend.
Ulof smiled.
I don't mind all that much when people disagree with me.
There is such a thing as genuine political progress. The people's lot is much better now than it was 500 years ago.
Granted. But what's it going to be like next year?
Ulof leaned back in his saddle, his blue eyes speculative.
Ambitious people need followers, and the best way to get people to follow you is to promise them that you're going to correct everything that's wrong with the world. The promises are all very stirring, but only babies expect leaders to actually keep them.
You're a cynic, Ulof.
I think that's the word people use, yes.
The weather grew increasingly threatening as the morning progressed. A thick bank of purplish cloud marched steadily in from the west, and there were flickers of lightning along the horizon.
It's going to rain, isn't it?
Tinian asked Halad. Halad looked pointedly toward the cloud bank.
That's a fairly safe bet, Sir Knight, the young man replied.
How long until we start to get wet?
An hour or so, unless the wind picks up.
What do you think, Sparhawk? Tinian asked. Should we look for some kind of shelter?
There was a far-off rumble of thunder from the west.
I think that answers that question, Sparhawk decided. Men dressed in steel don't have any business being out in a thunderstorm.
Good point, Tinian agreed.
He looked around. The next question is where?
I don't see any woods around.
We might have to set up the tents.
That's awfully tedious, Sparhawk.
So's being fried in your armor if you get struck by lightning.
Kring came riding back toward the main column with a small two-wheeled carriage following him. The man in the carriage was blonde, plump, and soft-looking. He wore clothing cut in a style that had gone out of fashion in the West 40 years ago.
This is the landowner Kotick, the Domi said to Sparhawk. He calls himself a baron. He wanted to meet you.
I am overwhelmed to meet the stalwarts of the church, Sir Knights, the plump man gushed.
We are honored, Baron Kotick,
Sparhawk replied, inclining his head politely.
My manor house is nearby, Kotick rushed on, and I do foresee unpleasant weather on the horizon. Might I offer my poor hospitality?
As I've told you so many times in the past, Sparhawk,
Bevier said mildly,
you have but to put your trust in God. He will provide.
Kotick looked puzzled.
A somewhat feeble attempt at humor, my lord, Sparhawk explained. My companions and I were just discussing our need for shelter. Your most generous offer solves a rather vexing problem for us.
Sparhawk was not familiar with local customs, but the baron's ornate speech hinted at a somewhat stiff formality.
I note that you have ladies in your company, Kotick observed, looking toward the carriage in which Elana rode.
Their comfort must be our first concern. We can become better acquainted once we are safely under my roof.
We shall be guided by you, my lord, Sparhawk agreed. I pray you, lead us whither you will, and I shall inform the ladies of this fortuitous encounter.
If Kotick wanted formal, Sparhawk would give him formal. He wheeled Farron and rode back along the column.
"Who's the fat fellow in the carriage,
Sparhawk?" Elana asked.
"Speak not disparagingly of our host, light of my life."
"Aren't you feeling well?"
"The fat fellow has just offered us shelter from that thunderstorm snapping at our heels. Treat him with gratitude, if not respect."
"What a nice man."
It might not be a bad idea for us to sort of keep your identity to ourselves. We don't know exactly what we're walking into. Why don't I just introduce you as an aristocrat of some kind and...
A Margravine, I think, she improvised. Margravine Elana of Cardos.
Why Cardos?
It's a nice district with mountains and a beautiful coastline. Absolutely perfect climate and industrious, law-abiding people.
You're not trying to sell it to him, Elana.
But I need to know the pertinent details so that I can gush suitably.
Sparhawk sighed.
All right, my lady. Practice gushing, then,
and come up with suitable stories for the others. He looked at M'Ban. Are your morals flexible enough to stand a bit of falsehood, Your Grace? He asked.
That depends on what you want me to lie about, Sparhawk.
It won't exactly be a lie, Your Grace. Sparhawk smiled. If we demote my wife, you'll be the ranking member of our party. The presence of Ambassador Oscania here suggests a high-level visit of some sort. I'll just tell Baron Kotick that you're the Archprelate's personal emissary to the Imperial Court, and that the knights are your escort instead of the Queen's.
That doesn't stretch my conscience too far,
M'Ban grinned.
Go ahead, Sparhawk. You lie, and I'll swear to it. Say whatever you have to. That storm is coming this way very fast.
Talon, Sparhawk said to the boy, who was riding beside the carriage. Sort of move up and down the column and let the knights know what we're doing. A misplaced Your Majesty or two could expose us all as frauds.
Your husband shows some promise, Margravine Elana, Stragan noted. Give me some time to train him a bit, and I'll make an excellent swindler of him. His instincts are good, but his technique's a little shaky.
Baron Kotick's manor house was a palatial residence in a park-like setting, and there was a fair-sized village at the foot of the hill upon which it stood. There were a number of large outbuildings standing to the rear of the main house.
"Fortunately, sir knights, I have ample room for even so large a party as yours," the baron told them. "The quarters for the bulk of your men may be a bit crude, though, I'm afraid. They're dormitories for the harvest crew."
"We're church knights, my lord Kotick," Sparhawk replied. "We're accustomed to hardship."
Kotick sighed.
"We have no such institution here in Astel," he mourned. "There are so many things lacking in our poor, backward country."
They approached the manor house by a long, white graveled drive, lined on both sides by lofty elms, and halted at the foot of the broad stone stairs leading up to an arched front door. The baron climbed heavily down from his carriage and handed his reins to one of the bearded serfs who had rushed from the house to meet them.
"I pray you, gentles all," he said, "stand not on ceremony. Let us enter ere the approaching storm descend upon us."
Sparhawk could not be certain if the baron's stilted speech was a characteristic of the country, a personal idiosyncrasy, or a nervous reaction to the rank of his visitors. He motioned to Calton and Tinian.
"See to it that the knights and the Paloi are settled in," he told them quietly. "Then join us in the house. Khalad, go with them. Make sure that the serfs don't just leave the horses standing out in the rain."
The door to the manor house swung wide, and three ladies dressed in antiquated gowns emerged. One was tall and angular. She had a wealth of dark hair and the lingering traces of youthful beauty. The years had not been kind to her, however. Her rigid, haughty face was lined, and she had a noticeable squint. The other two were both blonde, flabby, and their features clearly revealed a blood relationship to the baron. Behind them came a pale young man dressed all in black velvet. He seemed to have a permanent sneer stamped on his face. His dark hair was done in long curls that cascaded down his back in an artfully arranged display. After the briefest of introductions, Kotick led them all inside. The tall, dark-haired lady was the baron's wife, Estancia. The two blondes were, as Sparhawk had guessed, his sisters, Urmud, the elder, and Katina, the younger. The pale young man was Baroness Estancia's brother, Elron, who, she proudly advised them in a voice hovering on the verge of adoration, was a poet.
"Do you think I could get away with pleading a sick headache?"
Elana murmured to Sparhawk as they followed the baron and his family down a long, tapestry-lined corridor toward the center of the house.
"This is going to be deadly, I'm afraid."
"If I have to put up with it, so do you," Sparhawk whispered. "We need the baron's roof, so we'll have to endure his hospitality."
She sighed.
"It might be a little more endurable if the whole place didn't reek of cooked cabbage."
They were led into a sitting room that was only slightly smaller than the throne room in Zamora, a musty-smelling room filled with stiff, uncomfortable chairs and divans,
and carpeted in an unwholesome-looking mustard yellow.
"We are so isolated here,"
Katina sighed to the Baroness Melodir,
"and so dreadfully out of fashion. My poor brother tries as best he can to keep abreast of what's happening in the West, but our remote location imprisons us and keeps visitors from our door. Ermud and I have tried over and over to persuade him to take a house in the capital where we can be near the center of things, but she won't hear of it. The estate came to my brother by marriage, and his wife's so terribly provincial. Would you believe that my poor sister and I are forced to have our gowns made up by serfs?"
Melodir put her palms to her cheeks in feigned shock.
"My goodness!" she exclaimed.
Katina reached for her handkerchief as tears of misery began to roll down her cheeks.
"Wouldn't your Eitan be more comfortable with the serfs, Margravine?"
Baroness Astancia was asking Elana, looking with some distaste at Mirtai.
"I rather doubt it, Baroness,"
Elana replied.
"And even if she were, I wouldn't be. I have powerful enemies, my lady, and my husband is much involved in the affairs of Alenia. The queen relies heavily upon him, and so I must look to my own defenses."
"I'll admit that your Eitan is imposing, Margravine," Astancia sniffed.
"But she's still only a woman, after all."
Elana smiled.
"You might tell that to the 10 men she's already killed, Baroness," she replied.
The Baroness stared at her in horror.
"The Eosian continent has a thin veneer of civilization, my lady," Stregan advised her. "But underneath it all, we're really quite savage."
"It's a tedious journey, Baron Kotick," Patriarch Emban said. "But the Archprelate and the Emperor have been in communication with each other since the collapse of Zenok, and they both feel that the time has come to exchange personal envoys. Misunderstandings can arise in the absence of direct contact, and the world has seen enough of war for a while."
"A wise decision, Your Grace." Kotick was quite obviously overwhelmed by the presence of people of exalted station in his house.
"I have some small reputation in the capital, Sir Bevier," Elrond was saying in a lofty tone of voice. "My poems are eagerly sought after by the intelligentsia. They're quite beyond the grasp of the unlettered, however. I'm particularly noted for my ability to convey colors. I do think that color is the very soul of the real world. I've been working on my Ode to Blue for the past 6 months."
"Astonishing perseverance," Bevier murmured.
"I try to be as thorough as possible," Elrond declared. "I've already composed 263 stanzas, and there's no end in sight, I'm afraid."
Bevier sighed.
"As a knight of the church, I have little time for literature," he mourned. "Because of my vocation, I must concentrate on military texts and devotional works. Sir Sparhawk is more worldly than I, and his descriptions of people and places verge sometimes on the poetic."
"I should be most interested,"
Elrond lied, his face revealing a professional's contempt for the efforts of amateurs.
"Does he touch at all on color?"
"More with light, I believe,"
Bevier replied.
"But then they're the same thing, aren't they? Color doesn't exist without light. I remember that once he described a street in the city of Jirok. The city lies on the coast of Rendor, where the sun pounds the earth like a hammer. Very early in the morning, before the sun rises, and when the night is just beginning to fade, the sky has the color of forged steel. It casts no shadows, and so everything seems etched by that sourceless gray. The buildings in Jirok are all white, and the women go to the wells before the sun comes up to avoid the heat of the day. They wear hooded robes and veils all in black, and they balance clay vessels on their shoulders. All untaught, they move with a grace beyond the capability of dancers. Their silent, beautiful procession marks each day's beginning as, like shadows, they greet the dawn in a ritual as old as time. Have you ever seen that peculiar light before the sun rises, Elrond?"
"I seldom rise before noon," the young man said stiffly.
"You should make an effort to see it sometime," Bevier suggested mildly. "An artist should be willing to make some sacrifices for his art, after all."
"I trust you'll excuse me,"
the young fellow with the dark curls said brusquely. He bowed slightly, and then fled, a mortified expression replacing his supercilious sneer.
That was cruel, Bevier, Sparhawk chided, and you put words in my mouth. I'll admit that you have a certain flair for language, though.
It had the desired effect, Sparhawk. If that conceited young ass had patronized me one more time, I'd have strangled him. 200-some-odd verses in an ode to the color blue? What a donkey.
The next time he bothers you about blue, describe Bellium to him.
Bevier shuddered. Not me, Sparhawk. Just the thought of it makes my blood run cold.
Sparhawk laughed and went over to the window to look at the rain slashing at the glass.
Danae came to his side and took his hand. Do we really have to stay here, Father? She asked. These people turn my stomach.
We need some place to shelter us from the rain, Danae.
I can make it stop raining, if that's all you're worried about. If one of those disgusting women starts talking baby talk to me one more time, I'm going to turn her into a toad.
I think I have a better idea.
Sparhawk bent and picked her up.
Act sleepy, he instructed.
Danae promptly went limp and dangled from his arms like a rag doll.
You're overdoing it, he told her.
He crossed to the far side of the room, gently laid her on a divan, and covered her with her traveling cloak.
Don't snore, he advised. You're not old enough to snore yet.
She gave him an innocent little look. I wouldn't do that, Sparhawk. Find my cat and bring her to me. Then her smile turned hard. Pay close attention to our host and his family, Father. I think you should see what kind of people they really are.
What are you up to?
Nothing. I just think you should see what they're really like.
I can see quite enough already.
No, not really. They're trying to be polite, so they're glossing over things. Let's take a look at the truth. For the rest of the evening, they'll tell you what they really think and feel.
I'd rather they didn't.
You're supposed to be brave, Sparhawk, and this horrid little family is typical of the gentry here in Astel. Once you understand them, you'll be able to see what's wrong with the kingdom. It might be useful.
Her eyes and face grew serious.
There's something here, Sparhawk, something we absolutely have to know.
What?
I'm not sure. Pay attention, Father. Somebody's going to tell you something important tonight. Now go find my cat.
The supper they were offered was poorly prepared, and the conversation at the table was dreadful.
Freed of constraint by Danae's spell, the Baron and his family said things they might normally have concealed, and their spiteful, self-pitying vanity emerged all the more painfully under the influence of the inferior wine they all swilled like common tavern drunkards.
I was not intended for this barbaric isolation,
Katina tearfully confided to poor Melodir.
Surely God could not have meant for me to bloom unnoticed so far from the lights and gaiety of the capital. We were cruelly deceived before my brother's marriage to that dreadful woman. Her parents led us to believe that the estate would bring us wealth and position, but it scarcely provides enough to keep us in this hovel. There's no hope that we shall ever be able to afford a house in Darsus.
She buried her face in her hands.
What shall become of me?
She wailed.
The lights, the balls, the hordes of suitors flocking to my door, dazzled by my wit and beauty. Oh, don't cry, Katina,
Ermud wailed.
If you cry, I shall surely cry too.
The sisters were so similar in appearance that Sparhawk had some difficulty telling them apart. Their plumpness was more like dough than flesh. Their colorless hair was limp and uninspired, and their complexions were bad. Neither of them was really very clean.
I try so hard to protect my poor sister,
Ermud blubbered to the long-suffering Melodir.
But this dreadful place is destroying her. There's no culture here. We live like beasts, like serfs. It's so meaningless. Life should have meaning, but what possible meaning can there be so far from the capital? That horrid woman won't permit our poor brother to sell this desolate waste so that we can take a proper residence in Darsus. We're trapped here, trapped, I tell you, and we shall live out our lives in this hideous isolation.
Then she, too, buried her face in her hands and wept. Melodyr sighed, rolling her eyes ceilingward.
"I have some influence with the governor of the district,"
Baron Kotick was telling Patriarch Emban with pompous self-importance.
"He relies heavily on my judgment. We've been having a deuce of a time with the burghers in town. Untitled rascals, every one of them. Runaway serfs, if the truth were known. They complain bitterly at each new tax and try to shift the burden to us. We pay quite enough in taxes already, thank you, and they're the ones who are demanding all the services. What good does it do me if the streets in town are paved? It's the roads that are important. I've said that to His Excellency the Governor over and over again."
The Baron was deep in his cups. His voice was slurred, and his head wobbled on his neck.
"All the burdens of the district are placed on our shoulders," he declared, his eyes filling with self-pitying tears. "I must support 500 idle serfs. Serfs so lazy that not even a flogging can get any work out of them. It's all so unfair. I'm an aristocrat, but that doesn't count for anything anymore."
The tears began to roll down his cheeks, and his nose started to run.
"No one seems to realize that the aristocracy is God's special gift to mankind. The burghers treat us no better than commoners. Considering our divine origins, such disrespect is the worst form of impiety. I'm sure your grace agrees."
The Baron sniffed loudly. Patriarch Emban's father had been a tavern keeper in the city of Usera, and Sparhawk was fairly sure that the fat little churchman most definitely did not agree. Ilana had been trapped by the Baron's wife, and she was beginning to look a little desperate.
"The estate's mine, of course," Estancia declared in a coldly haughty voice. "My father was in his dotage when he married me off to that fat swine," she sneered. "Kotick only had those piggish little eyes of his on the income from my estate. My father was so impressed with the idiot's title that he couldn't see him for what he really is. A titled opportunist with two fat, ugly sisters hanging from his coattails." She sneered, and then the sneer slid from her face, and the inevitable tears filled her eyes.
"I can only find solace for my tragic state in religion, my beloved brother's art, and in the satisfaction I take in making absolutely sure those two harridans never see the lights of Darsus. They'll rot here, right up until the moment my pig of a husband eats and drinks himself to death. Then I shall turn them out with nothing but the clothes on their backs."
Her hard eyes became exultant.
"I can hardly wait," she said fiercely. "I shall have my revenge, and then my sainted brother and I can live here in perfect contentment."
Princess Danae crawled up into her father's lap.
"Lovely people, aren't they?" she said quietly.
"Are you making all this up?" he asked accusingly.
"No, father, I can't do that. None of us can. People are what they are. We can't change them."
"I thought you could do anything."
"There are limits, Sparhawk."
Her dark eyes grew hard again.
"I am going to do something, though."
"Oh?"
"Your Aline god owes me a couple of favors. I did something nice for him once."
"Why do you need his help?"
"These people are Aline's. They belong to him. I can't do anything to them without his permission. That's the worst form of bad manners."
"I'm an Aline, and you do things to me."
"You're Annika, Sparhawk. You don't belong to anybody."
"That's depressing. I'm loose in the world with no god to guide me."
"You don't need guidance. Advice sometimes, yes. Guidance, no."
"Don't do anything exotic here," he cautioned. "We don't know exactly what we'll be dealing with when we get deeper into Tomalley. Let's not announce our presence until we have to."
Then his curiosity got the better of him.
"Nobody's said anything very relevant yet."
"Then keep listening, Sparhawk. It will come."
Exactly what were you planning to ask God to do to these people?
Nothing,
she replied.
Absolutely nothing at all. I won't ask him to do a thing to change their circumstances. All I want him to do is to make sure that they all live very, very long lives.
He looked around the table at the petulant faces of their host's family.
You're going to imprison them here, he accused. Chain 5 people who loathe each other together for all eternity so that they can gradually tear each other to pieces.
Not quite eternity, Sparhawk, the little girl corrected, though it's probably going to seem that way to them.
That's cruel.
No, Sparhawk, it's justice. These people richly deserve each other. I only want to be sure that they have a long time to enjoy each other's company.
What's your feeling about a breath of fresh air? Stragan asked, leaning over Sparhawk's shoulder.
It's raining out there.
I don't think you'll melt.
Maybe it's not a bad idea at that.
Sparhawk rose to his feet and carried his sleeping daughter back into the sitting room and the divan where Myrrh drowsed, purring absently and kneading one of the cushions with her needle-sharp claws. He covered them both and followed Stragan into the corridor.
Are you feeling restless? He asked the Thalesian. No. Revolted. I've known some of the worst people in the world, my friend, and I'm no angel myself, but this little family...
He shuddered.
Did you happen to lay in a store of poison while you were in Rendor?
I don't approve of poison.
A bit short-sighted there, old boy. Poison's a tidy way to deal with intolerable people. And I has felt much the same way, as I recall. I'd forgotten about that, Stragan admitted. I imagine that prejudiced you slightly against a very practical solution to a sticky problem. Something really ought to be done about these monsters, though.
It's already been taken care of.
Oh? How?
I'm not at liberty to say.
They stepped out onto the wide veranda that ran across the back of the house and stood leaning on the railing, looking out into the muddy backyard.
It doesn't show any signs of letting up, does it?
Stragan said.
How long can it continue at this time of year?
You'll have to ask Khalad. He's the expert on the weather.
My lords?
Stragan and Sparhawk turned. It was Elrond, the Baron's poetic brother-in-law.
I came to assure you that my sister and I aren't responsible for Kotick and his relatives, he said.
We were fairly sure that was the case, Elrond, Stragan murmured.
All they had in the world was Kotick's title. Their father gambled away their inheritance. It sickens me to have that clutch of out-at-the-elbows aristocrats lording it over us the way they do.
We've heard some rumors.
Stragan smoothly changed the subject.
Some people in Essos were telling us that there was unrest among the serfs. We got some garbled account of a fellow called Saber and another named Ayachin. We couldn't make any sense out of it.
Elrond looked around in an overdramatically conspiratorial fashion.
It is not wise to mention those names here in Astell, Milord Stragan, he said in a hoarse whisper that probably could have been heard across the yard. The Tommels have ears everywhere.
The serfs are unhappy with the Tommels?
Stragan asked with some surprise.
I'd have thought that they wouldn't have had so far to look for someone to hate.
The serfs are superstitious animals, my lord, Elrond sneered. They can be led anywhere with a combination of religion, folklore, and strong drink. The real movement is directed at the Yellow Devils.
Elrond's eyes narrowed.
The honor of Astell demands that the Tommel yoke be thrown off. That's the real goal of the movement. Saber is a patriot, a mysterious figure who appears out of the night to inspire the men of Astell to rise up and smash the oppressor's chains. He's always masked, you know.
I hadn't heard that.
Oh, yes. It's necessary, of course. Actually, he's a well-known personage who very carefully conceals his real identity and opinions. By day, he's an idle member of the gentry, but at night, he's a masked firebrand, igniting the patriotism of his countrymen.
You have certain opinions, I gather, Stragan assumed.
Elrond's expression grew cautious.
"I'm only a poet, Milord Stragan," he said deprecatingly. "My interest is in the drama of the situation. For the purposes of my art, you understand."
"Oh, of course." "Where does this Ayachin come in?" Sparhawk asked. "As I understand it, he's been dead for quite some time now."
"There are strange things afoot in Astel, Sir Sparhawk," Elrond assured him. "Things which have lain locked in the blood of all true Astels for generations. We know in our hearts that Ayachin is not dead. He can never die, not so long as tyranny is alive."
"Just as a practical consideration, Elrond," Stragan said in his most urbane manner, "this movement seems to rely rather heavily on the serfs for manpower. What's in it for them? Why should men who are bound to the soil have any concern at all about who runs the government?"
"They're sheep. They'll stampede in any direction you want them to. All you have to do is murmur the word emancipation, and they'd follow you into the mouth of hell."
"Then Saber has no intention of actually freeing them?"
Elrond laughed. "My dear fellow, why would any reasonable man want to do that? What's the point of liberating cattle?" He looked around furtively. "I must return before I'm missed. Kotick hates me, and he'd like nothing better than the chance to denounce me to the authorities. I'm obliged to smile and be polite to him and those two overfed sows he calls his sisters. I keep my own counsel, gentlemen, but when the day of our liberation comes, there will be changes here, as God is my judge. Social change is sometimes violent, and I can almost guarantee that Kotick and his sisters will not live to see the dawn of the new day." His eyes narrowed with a kind of self-important secretiveness. "But I speak too much. I keep my own counsel, gentlemen. I keep my own counsel." He swirled his black cloak around him and crept back into the house, his head high and his expression resolute.
"Fascinating young fellow," Stragan observed. "He makes my rapier itch for some reason."
Sparhawk grunted his agreement and looked up at the rainy night.
"I hope this blows over by morning," he said. "I'd really like to get out of this sewer."
Chapter 11. The following morning dawned blustery and unpromising. Sparhawk and his companions ate a hasty breakfast and made ready to depart. The Baron and his family were not awake as yet, and none of his guests were in any mood for extended farewells. They rode out about an hour after sunrise and turned northeasterly on the Darsis Road, moving at a distance-consuming canter. Although none of them mentioned it, they all wanted to get well out of the range of any possible pursuit before their hosts awakened. About mid-morning, they reached the white stone pillar that marked the eastern border of the Baron's estate, and breathed a collective sigh of relief. The column slowed to a walk, and Sparhawk and the other knights dropped back to ride alongside the carriage. Ilana's maid, Aileen, was crying, and the Queen and Baroness Melodir were trying to comfort her.
"She's a very gentle child," Melodir explained to Sparhawk. "The horror of that sorry household has moved her to tears."
"Did someone back there say something to you he shouldn't have?" Kaltan asked the sobbing girl, his tone hard.
End of Side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.